This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. President Trump is making his way around Europe and making waves with his words. In an interview with the British tabloid The Sun, President Trump criticized Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May in her own country.
I would have done it much differently. I actually told Theresa May how to do it, but she didn't agree with it. She didn't listen to me.
And then, in a press conference today with Prime Minister May standing next to him, he said he did not criticize her.
I didn't criticize the Prime Minister. I have a lot of respect for the Prime Minister. And unfortunately, there was a story that was done, which was, you know, generally fine, but it didn't put in what I said about the Prime Minister. And I said tremendous things. And fortunately, we tend to record stories now, so we have it for your enjoyment if you'd like it. But we record when we deal with reporters. It's called fake news.
Those moments came after days of controversial remarks from Mr. Trump at the NATO summit in Brussels. Soon he'll be on his way to Finland to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Talk about controversy. We will talk about where Mr. Trump has been, where he's going, and how what he is saying affects America's reputation. Meanwhile, here at home, Democrats are gearing up to try and fight the confirmation of conservative Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Congress remains at a stalemate on immigration policy, and some parents who were separated from their children at the southern border are still wondering if a reunion will happen. Joining us today for the Friday News Roundup is Eugene Scott, a political reporter for The Washington Post. Eugene, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Also glad to welcome back Inez Stepman, senior contributor to The Federalist. Inez, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Ed O'Keefe, a political correspondent for CBS News. Hi,
Ed. Glad to be with you, Josh.
Well, the world has been very eager to weigh in on President Trump's performance abroad this week. So, at least for the top of the program, we thought we'd invite one more guest to the roundup to help us with some international perspective. Joining us from London is John Prideaux, an editor for The Economist. John, welcome to 1A.
Thanks, Joshua. Hi, everyone.
Can we start with that comment or those two contradictory comments? The president said to The Sun very critical things to Theresa May. Then in the news conference, like minutes before we went on the air, he said that never happened. What do you make of that?
Well, it's a major whiplash watching it. You're absolutely right. I mean, the president gave this interview with The Sun pretty much just as he arrived in the UK, said that Theresa May's plan for Brexit, which is the biggest thing her government's dealing with at the moment, would make it impossible to do a trade deal with America, you know, praised her rival for the Conservative leadership, Boris Johnson. And it's hard to imagine a more destabilizing series of remarks, really, more unhelpful series of remarks for Theresa May. President Trump's just finished a press conference with Theresa May here in the UK, and he tried to clean it up a little bit, talked about how fantastic she was, stroked kind of British egos a little when he was asked about the special relationship. Brits have an obsession with the idea that they have a special relationship with America. He called it the highest level of special. Now, I suppose anybody who's watched the president for a while has gotten used to this idea that he doesn't really feel bound by things he said even yesterday. And it was another example of that, albeit a pretty extraordinary one, given, as you say, you know, the recording of him saying what he says he didn't say exists.
One kind of wonders what was going through Theresa May's mind at that time. She's standing right next to him as he said something that was demonstrably false and just didn't crack a smile, didn't react. She's dealing with quite a bit, and now she had to stand there as the president said that he didn't say the thing we all heard him say.
Well, so I think what is the case is that news organizations often pick out the most interesting bits from interviews and put them in the headline. And most politicians are pretty used to that idea, right? It's no great surprise that if you attack the prime minister of your host country and praise one of her rivals, that's the bit that the newspaper is going to pick out. The kind of surprising thing to me, to some extent, is that the president hasn't got used to that already, or kind of thinks that that process is fake news, which it's not. That's kind of how news is made, right?
There have been a lot of protests in Britain against President Trump, including one that is going on as we speak. Talk about how those have gone. I presume they've been mostly peaceful, right?
They have been mostly peaceful, though they've required a large police presence. These protests are pretty extraordinary. I mean, just bear in mind that London is a city that really likes American presidents generally. I mean, we have a statue of George Washington outside our National Gallery in Trafalgar Square. There's a statue of Lincoln outside Parliament. There are statues of Eisenhower, Kennedy, Reagan. I may have forgotten a few elsewhere in town. even during the Iraq War, when there were marches against the Iraq War, you know, they weren't directed against President George W. Bush kind of personally. These ones are very different. A, there are an awful lot of people out on the streets. B, it's very personal, very much directed at President Trump. So it's pretty extraordinary what's going on. They've been a little controversial here in the UK. I mean, I think there are quite a lot of people here who think that even though you may disagree with the president, dislike him, you know, it's important to kind of respect the office and therefore, you know, protesting against the presence of your kind of greatest and oldest ally is a kind of counterproductive thing to do. But yeah, it's very striking what's going on here. Very unusual reception for an American president.
We're speaking to John Prideaux, London-based U.S. editor for The Economist. We welcome your questions as well about the top stories of this week, 1A at WAMU.org. Speaking of protests directed at the president, John, it's interesting that a particular rock song has been climbing the charts thanks to a social media campaign. It's a song that hasn't been a hit in 14 years. Don't wanna be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. Hey, American Idiot by Green Day climbed the charts this week, and I believe, John, that that's directed at President Trump. Is that part of the protest?
It seems to be. I have to say, listening to that song brought back some memories for me. This dates me a little bit, but I remember going to Green Day.
You're not the only one. I think it's dating several of us.
I remember going to a Green Day gig in the UK and nearly being sort of crushed to death by fans who were kind of jumping around.
That's a good concert, man. That's how it's supposed to work.
It was terrific. But it's certainly true that President Trump is in some senses to some Europeans, the kind of cliche of what people say they don't like about Americans. I mean, when I was talking earlier about kind of the UK kind of love affair for the US, there's also a different strain within kind of European thinking, or maybe thinking is elevating it too much, kind of prejudice when it comes to American. You know, a stereotype that, you know, the American abroad is kind of boorish, doesn't appreciate kind of European food, thinks America's the kind of only interesting place, you know, can be rude, only cares about money and so forth. And there is, you know, some ways in which the president is the kind of caricature that these people kind of think of. So I think that explains the song's kind of current popularity. It's also a great tune, right?
Exactly. Let me bring it back here to the DC studio. Ed O'Keefe, you wanted to jump in.
Well, John, given that Donald Trump is so unpopular in the UK, explain or remind us why what he said about Brexit specifically is so unhelpful to the prime minister. If anything, much like up in Canada, she might conjure up some more sympathy from the British public for the fact that he doesn't like her, because they'll say, well, gosh, if he doesn't like her, then I like her because I don't like him.
That's a really good point, Ed. And I think there's something to that. I mean, there was a question asked about immigration at the joint press conference. Donald Trump gave a kind of lengthy speech about how, immigration's been terrible for Europe. The same question was put to Prime Minister May. She gave the exact opposite answer. You know, she said immigration's been great for the UK and et cetera. So, she's in an odd position where he is not very popular. And yet, because the most important thing at the moment that the British government is trying to deal with is Brexit, because she's been selling her version of Brexit on the basis that it will allow Britain to go around negotiating free trade deals with other countries like America, it was really important for her, you know, in terms of her kind of control of the message about Brexit, control over her party, that the American president should be helpful on that, should say, well, you know, of course, America would love to do a deal with Britain one day or something like that. Instead, he came out and said pretty much the opposite of that at a very sensitive time in British politics. So it's... You know, being criticized by Donald Trump won't hurt her in one way, for the reasons you say. He's not hugely popular here. But it just, you know, the timing of it is super, super delicate at the moment. And the president went some way to repairing that in the press conference. But I think the damage was kind of done.
More we want to discuss on this, but let me get to some of your comments first. John emailed, let's stop putting lipstick on this pig. He's lying. Stop helping Trump and start calling his lies lies. And the next time he says, I'm not calling on you because you are fake news at a news conference, all those journalists should get up and walk out. Putting up with his lies and attacks is just enabling him. Michael writes, Trump said the Sun article was mostly correct, but had left out positive comments he made about May. What do you find demonstrably false about this statement? Inez Stepman, I wonder if you could kind of respond to that, the public perception of this. I do take the point from both of them. You know, I see where they're coming from. But it's clear the president denied saying something that he said, and we have him on tape saying it.
Well, it's not the first time that President Trump or candidate Trump has denied things that were on tape elsewhere. But I think the deeper issue here, part of his whole critique of the prime minister was based around this bilateral trade deal, free trade deal that both I think the UK and the US want, right? I think the president clearly wants that deal. There's some potential misunderstandings about his understanding of what her version of that deal might entail and how that might impact, her version of Brexit might impact that bilateral deal. But you saw him reverse himself specifically on that point and saying, as long as we can get this deal, it's your business. It's your business how you conduct Brexit. And I think that maybe that's the deeper issue here.
And also to Michael's comment about that, it's actually not true that that it left out positive comments. There are positive comments in the Sun article, including denying claims that Theresa May bores him. So they did include some positive comments. Amy in New Hampshire writes, I'm glad journalists and leaders abroad are standing up to and questioning Trump and his abhorrent policy statements and behavior. The cowards in America won't, so I'm glad to see people in other countries doing it. Our buddy Brian in Bartlett, New Hampshire writes, am I just old-fashioned or is it no longer fashionable to be tactful? We have Trump being as uncouth as he possibly can. We have Congress conducting hearings that only seem to be about insulting FBI agents for their personal opinions. Is this an intentional tactic, a cynical attempt to appeal to the lowest common denominator? I was taught to continually try to be better than I am. Our leaders seem to be encouraging us to regress by inflaming people's fears and emotions. We'll talk about that hearing regarding FBI agent Peter Strzok in just a moment, but let's shift gears to Brussels, where President Trump criticized NATO allies and pressed for large spending increases. At the end of that summit, Mr. Trump said America's ties to NATO are very strong, and he added that he won big concessions on defense spending.
I let them know that I was extremely unhappy with what was happening, and they have substantially upped their commitment. Yeah. And now we're very happy and have a very, very powerful, very, very strong NATO, much stronger than it was 2 days ago.
John Prideaux, what's your read on how NATO countries, the NATO allies, reacted to all this?
Well, this is a pretty amazing summit, wasn't it? It began with the president berating his European allies for not spending enough on defense. There's some truth to that. But then he had a go at Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor, saying that at one point that Germany is controlled by Russia because it buys so much of its gas from Russia. That's not quite true. I was talking to a colleague here earlier. Germany apparently relies on Russian gas for about 9% of its energy needs. So we're unused to seeing these kind of divisions within the alliance kind of spill out into the open. And it's another kind of example of this very unusual way in which the president does diplomacy. I mean, most people, and certainly most heads of state, have things that they'll say in public and things that they'll say in private. And President Trump doesn't seem to separate those two categories. You know, he just goes right on in there. By the end of the summit, I think they patched it over a little bit. There was actually quite a strong communique on Russia. And again, when the president came to England, he was asked about Russia and asked about NATO, and he tried to spin it as, well, you know, I got exactly what I wanted out of NATO. They're all going to raise their defense spending and we're stronger than ever. But it was, I mean, make no mistake, this was very, very unusual.
Eugene Scott, the Senate sent a pretty strong message on Tuesday before the president's trip. It voted nearly unanimously on a motion supporting NATO. Talk about the way that Congress has been reacting to the president's rhetoric on NATO.
It was quite surprising to some people who have expressed frustration with Republican lawmakers' unwillingness to push back on things that the president has said in the past. I think Republican lawmakers and obviously Democratic lawmakers made it very clear that they support NATO in a way that Trump's comments earlier this week did not mirror, and that they felt like for America to be strong in the area of military and other national security issues, we had to stand alongside NATO as much as possible.
Peggy in Tacoma Park, Maryland asks, after the, to put it politely, tumultuous meeting, where does NATO stand? Is the alliance unraveling, or is this the, just the usual Trump bluster with no real effect on NATO? The problem with Trump in NATO and all things is you can't tell what isn't true, nor whether he'll change his mind and do a 180 reversal. Ed, what about Peggy's question? Where does NATO stand after all this?
I think what we'll have to track in the next few days is what kind of cleanup or explaining are the Defense and State Departments doing with their counterparts all over the world in the wake of these meetings this week. There's some reporting this morning that suggests the Pentagon especially has been working the phones to sort of reassure especially NATO allies that all is good, don't worry, we're still with you. Look, the goal that the president had, which is to get every one of the NATO members to boost their defense spending to at least 2% of their GDP, and then he said to get to 4%, is ongoing. And it's frankly something that has bothered every U.S. president in modern history. They just haven't been as upfront about it the way he has. And I keep thinking to myself every time he does this, I can't think of a basic American voter out there who's going to have any problem with an American president going to the rest of the world and saying, if you're part of this group, pay up. This is something that Republicans have done, especially with the United Nations for years, and now he's doing it with NATO. And I think to myself, this is exactly what his supporters would want to hear. And frankly, I think a lot of independent-minded voters probably don't have an issue with it either, because if the United States is putting up as much money and manpower as it does for this group, why shouldn't Estonia or Greece or the United Kingdom and everyone else? And so that's basically the argument he's been making. He did not say and did not get up from the room and leave. What I think happened is that a lot of these diplomats, a lot of these leaders got a taste of what congressional Republicans and Democrats see on an almost weekly basis here in Washington, which is a guy who brings you all together pretty quickly, pretty dramatically, says some things, and then things calm down and, you know, people move on.
Ines Stepman, what's your read of how all this rhetoric on NATO plays with the president's base? He's brought it up in a number of his campaign events, or his rallies, I should say, not campaign events, over the last few weeks. We've talked about the necessity of NATO or the value of NATO on this program. How do you think this plays politically?
I think it plays really well. I agree. I think it plays really well for his base and also with independents. I think there is a broad segment of the American population that believes that our post-World War II institutions have to be reevaluated, not necessarily eviscerated, but reevaluated. And I agree that Trump frequently comes out with, you know, really, really extreme or bold statements initially and then walks it back to something much more reasonable, which, as you said, has been something that American presidents and the American public has been calling for a long time. When NATO was founded, you know, we're in a post-World War II world. Europe is still reeling from the effect of that. Now Europe has an economy that's 10 times the size of Russia, right? It's totally fair to expect that they will pony up for their own defense.
One more comment, John, before I let you go. Marie writes, Trump is an abrasive New York businessman, but he is right on NATO, and his request for them to up their spending will scare Russia and keep them safer. And he's right on Brexit. The citizens that voted for it are not in London, so let London protest. Most of London are not British. And he's right on trade, especially with China. They steal our intellectual property. We had a great diplomat with Obama, but he was not a good president. He got nothing done. He spent his time making Hollywood and Europe happy and writing executive orders, and this is the result. Before you comment, John, I should note, I did a quick search about that comment about most of London not being British. The 2011 census shows that 45% of Londoners describe themselves as white British, but London only has about 37% of its population born outside the UK. So Marie is partially correct. Most of London is not white, but most of London is native British, just to clarify. So, John, before we let you go, what do you make of Marie's comment?
Thanks, Joshua. Well, there's a lot in there. Just very quickly, I'll try and deal with them point by point. On NATO, you know, as Ed and others have said, you know, the president has a point here. Some of the NATO allies haven't been keeping their commitment to spend as much as they should on defense. I think it's a point that previous American presidents have made, albeit in a different way. That said, NATO is quite a fragile thing. It's basically built around an article of faith. Article 5 in the NATO Charter says that an attack on one is an attack on all. And that's why notes of kind of solidarity with other members of NATO is quite so important. If you're sitting in the Baltic states now, if you're, you know, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and you're thinking, I've got Vladimir Putin on my border, and I think there's a chance he might want to test how strong NATO is. I don't think the kind of comments that the president has made are reassuring to you. And so I think that's the concern there. And that's why, as Ed says, you know, bits of the Pentagon will be working the phones very hard, saying to their allies, guys, you know, don't be freaked out. Nothing has changed. On Brexit, the president clearly kind of waded into a very, you know, the most divisive issue in British politics at the moment. The vote was pretty much 50-50. You know, the country is evenly split. Getting out of the European Union turns out to be much more complicated than those who voted to leave ever expected. About half the country agrees with President Trump, about half doesn't. On China, again, this is an area where lots of American presidents have found the way that China uses the rules of the multilateral trading system to its benefit really, really hard. You know, that independent of whether President Trump had been elected in 2016, there would be a kind of China problem that the West was facing on economics and also on security. It's really the way the president goes about trying to resolve that problem which is problematic.
John Prideaux, an editor for The Economist based in London. John, pleasure talking to you. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks, Joshua. Thanks, guys.
Let's continue the roundup now with Eugene Scott of The Washington Post, Inez Stettman of The Federalist, and Ed O'Keefe of CBS News. Back here in Washington, FBI agent Peter Strzok testified on Capitol Hill yesterday. Mr. Strzok was removed from Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation for sending anti-Trump texts during the 2016 presidential election. If you watched any of this really long hearing yesterday, you know things got pretty heated very quickly. Here's Mr. Strzok in an exchange with the chair of the House Oversight Committee, Congressman Trey Gowdy, a Republican from South Carolina.
This isn't just me sitting here telling you. You don't have to take my word for it. At every step, at every investigative decision, there are multiple layers of people above me, the assistant director, executive assistant director, deputy director, and director of the FBI, and multiple layers of people below me, section chiefs, supervisors, unit chiefs, case agents, and analysts, all of whom were involved in all of these decisions. They would not tolerate any improper behavior in me any more than I would tolerate it in them. That is who we are as the FBI. And the suggestion that I, in some dark chamber somewhere in the FBI, would somehow cast aside all of these procedures, all of these safeguards, and somehow be able to do this is astounding to me. It simply couldn't happen. And the proposition that that is going on, that it might occur anywhere in the FBI, deeply corrodes what the FBI is in American society, the effectiveness of their mission, and it is deeply destructive.
That was FBI agent Peter Strzok clapping back at South Carolina Congressman Trey Gowdy during yesterday's hearing. Eugene Scott, what happened? Why did this hearing get so heated? Was this a diversion from what people expected from this hearing, or did we kind of know this was going to be hot?
I think anyone who watched the hearings involving Hillary Clinton during the election should not have been that surprised by the theatrics and the performance and the desire to score points with your tribe and the network and media publications that tend to report on you more favorably. Yesterday, we saw so much performance and so many people touting lines that had been touted throughout the news making of this this story involving Peter Strzok. I'm not quite sure that we got any new information that made people who already had ideas about where he stood and how inappropriate or how meaningless his actions were that changed any minds. I do think we got some clarifications that, depending on where you sit, aren't that believable or sounded as if they could have possibly made any sense. But what we did get was 9.5 hours of clips that we will probably be hearing repeatedly until the midterm elections.
Yeah, Inez, I was just thinking about that. Like, this was 9.5 hours of everybody's life. And was the political theater the point of this? Was this just an opportunity in their capacity and their power as the House Oversight Committee to flog Peter Strzok in public? Was that the point of this?
I mean, I think that was part of the point. And then from the Democrat side, it was to allow him to make his point, as you just played. I think there is a lot of theater that played into this. But as you said, I don't think that there were a whole lot of specific questions answered. He declined to give answers on specific investigations. And the problem is that his role a lot of the decision making he was doing is inherently subjective. It's decisions that are really, really difficult to then, you know, go back and say, was this your motivation or was this your motivation? They're close calls or they're subjective calls. And I do think that you have to ask yourself, if you were under investigation and you saw that the person in charge of those subjective calls had sent those kinds of texts, would you feel that that investigation was uncompromised? Would you feel that that was a fair investigation or an unbiased investigator? And I think that's the baseline here.
There's also the fact, Ed, that there's another hearing to be had with Lisa Page, the former FBI agent who received the text that Mr. Strzok sent. She's supposed to testify on Capitol Hill today. Well, I understand where he's coming from. Like, I see what Peter Strzok is trying to say. Like, if you're saying that I am the one linchpin that blew this whole thing up, you got to talk to everybody else above me, everybody else around me. How does his testimony factor into what Lisa Page might say and into wherever this goes from here?
Well, and she's only being interviewed behind closed doors.
Right, hers is not public.
A few weeks ago. He may not have been the linchpin that caused the investigations to go sideways one way or the other, but he is the one linchpin that totally upended the credibility of the FBI in the minds of many people. And for that, perhaps the flogging was justified. And if you listened closely over the course of those 9.5 hours, as I sadly had to, hashtag day job, you know, there were several Democrats who were quite upset with him as well, because they said, if not for what the FBI did by not revealing that Donald Trump was also under investigation at the same time that Hillary Clinton was under investigation, maybe she'd be president right now. And they said, by doing what you did on your work phone, you have totally upended the credibility of the nation's premier law enforcement agency. So he doesn't get away with this necessarily. He did do this. He did do it on his work phone. Don't text on your work phones, people.
Although maybe in his defense a little bit, I think the Democrats have had gripes with the FBI beyond Peter Strzok. James Comey comes to mind.
Absolutely. And that's what that was their point, is that you were part of Comey's FBI that was doing these things. You were part of the problem. Did he deserve to get dragged through the mud the way he was? That's up for debate, and most don't. And I would say this, having watched plenty of these hearings, it was rare to see a witness push back on the inquisitors as much as he did yesterday, questioning their motives and sort of giving it to them a little more than most do. Whether he did that under the advice of counsel or whether he was so ticked off, I don't know, but that's something we don't see a lot of, and I suspect in the future we now will see, because it did get under the skin of some of those lawmakers who clearly were not prepared for him to push back.
Eugene?
Absolutely, I agree. Yesterday's conversation that was most interesting to me was this idea that bias is something that your political opponent has or people not like you have. And there wasn't a lot of self-reflection from everyone at the table, be it the left or right or law enforcement, that bias is something that does influence how you do your job, can benefit some folks, hurt other folks, and that our law enforcement, that our politics just aren't as objective as many people in those places want us to believe.
Plenty more we want to discuss as we continue the roundup, but V is listening here in Washington. V writes, what is Trey Gowdy, the Congressman Trey Gowdy, auditioning for? Correct me if I am wrong, but he is no great fan of Trump and is not running for re-election. Coming up, another presidential pardon breeds another round of controversy. Still plenty to talk about with immigration this week. There was a significant deadline that came and went. Where does the process stand of reuniting families that were separated at the southern border? And before we go, don't know if you heard about the Emmy nominations that came out this week, but where does the name Emmy, the name of that statuette, where does it come from? Don't Google it. The answer's just ahead. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Corporate.
Income.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
Back now to the roundup with Ed O'Keefe, Inez Stepman, and Eugene Scott. A few more comments on Peter Strzok and that hearing from this week. Frank is watching us on Facebook, and he writes, "The thing we learned is that Senate hearings, or in this case House hearings, are just stages for GOP grandstanding." Richard tweeted, "Hard to get any important info when the FBI thinks its right to privacy is more important than the public's right to transparency and accountability." Inez, we were just chatting about that point that Richard made over the break, that this is one of the things, including with James Comey's testimony and that whole investigation, that gave critics of the FBI more fodder to say, this is exactly our problem with the FBI. We know you have to keep secrets, but you don't have to keep all the secrets from everybody all the time.
Yeah, and they're keeping secrets from the body that's supposed to oversee them, right? They're keeping secrets from Congress. It's not even talking about releasing to the public, which some things have been. But we're talking about keeping secrets from the Democratic body that's supposed to oversee them. Obviously, small d Democratic, not large. And I actually think it's a larger point about the civil service. The FBI is just one branch of this, right? We have an administrative state that's largely unaccountable. Personnel are largely unaccountable to the American public via those Democratic bodies, right? So via either Congress, congressional oversight, or by the president, right? The executive branch. The president actually has very little control over anyone below the political level in the executive branch. And I think that's a long-term problem in the United States.
Although we should be clear, Inez, that part of the criticism of some of these hearings has also been the public nature of them. There are plenty of opportunities for, you know, the Intelligence Committee and Judiciary Committees and others to hold closed-door hearings and ask questions in private that could be answered privately, but that if answered publicly could be more compromising.
Right, and there are different kinds of information. Obviously, we understand that as a law enforcement agency, there are things that cannot be made public. But, I mean, some of the things that have been redacted are things like how much money the FBI spent on a desk, $70,000. They redacted that. That's obviously not something the public cannot know. And I think there's a general problem with both public and representative oversight over all of the administrative state.
Before I let you jump in, Ed, Glenna was watching on Facebook. Glenna writes, "Strzok was guilty of being human." Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe, but again, he was working on some sensitive stuff. So,
right.
You know, one other point, Eugene's colleague, my buddy Paul Kane, made the point yesterday on Twitter, he covers Congress for the Post, that in most of these investigative hearings back in the day, you'd have a top lawyer for both sides handling most of the questions, a chief counsel. That's how Bobby Kennedy made his name back in the 50s. Remember, he was the one working for Joe McCarthy's Investigative Activities Committee.
He was chief counsel for Joe McCarthy.
Yeah, Fred Thompson, the former Law and Order actor, he did that too during the Watergate hearings. Like, there was some suggestion yesterday that maybe these committees should think about going back to finding one guy that can ask all the questions on their behalf. The problem is, of course, the members of the committee wouldn't get the airtime
right.
And the tryouts for the cable news contributorships that they
book
all
deals,
want.
Book deals, teaching gigs.
Let's shift gears and talk about immigration at the southern border that has not fallen out of the headlines despite everything else going on this week. Tuesday was the court-ordered deadline to reunite families who had been separated. Reports suggest that process is chaotic, to say the least, and the newest iterations of a tougher immigration policy are causing issues in their own rights. Eugene Scott, could you catch us up? From the Tuesday deadline, the deadline's come and gone. Where are we now? Are any of the families getting reunited, or does it still remain just pure chaos?
Some are. As of Tuesday, I think there are about 38 of the slightly more than 100 parents of children 5 and under actually ended up being reunited, which is obviously far shorter, far smaller of a number than what was demanded from the Trump administration. And moving forward, a clear plan has not been laid out communicating how some of these reunifications are going to occur. Some of the parents have said that they have not been able to prove their parenthood, that they've been asked to provide like birth certificates and other documentation that they did not bring with them. We've had reports of young kids not recognizing parents once there was reunification, which you can imagine raises some questions and concerns from some of those involved in the process, wondering if what they did was accurate or right. And so we are not as far along in this process as we were expecting we would be by now. But the Trump administration has certainly expressed concern about that and a direction or a desire to move in a direction that could remedy that. Specifics about that just haven't been made clear yet.
Yeah, Inez, one of the aspects of that that the Justice Department had tried to move was asking to overturn parts of a settlement known as the Flores Settlement that requires migrant children to be held in certified daycare centers for up to 20 days and no longer. Yesterday, the Justice Department asked a federal judge to overturn parts of that, and that request was denied. Where do we stand now in terms of the administration figuring out a way, and maybe this was never going to be quick, but where do we stand now in terms of the administration figuring out a way to really finally resolve this?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a longer-term problem than many people realize. And it's something I think we've created some unintended incentives with the way that we have failed to enforce our laws in the last couple decades. We have created a system, more or less, where if you come to the border with a child and you declare asylum, we have this Flores problem, right? So if you're an adult and you declare asylum, we hold you in detention until that case can be adjudicated. And otherwise, you're subject to immediate deportment. So deportation. So there's an incentive to claim asylum no matter what. But if you come with a child, then they can't hold you for longer than 20 days because of this Flores settlement. And so a lot of times people were just released into the United States and then didn't show up for their hearings. But we have created an incentive for trafficking. Now, there are undoubtedly families who come with their children. I'm not trying to deny that. But we've created an incentive for trafficking, which is why then this reunification problem, we need to make sure that the people who showed up at the border with their children are actually, it's actually their children, because we have created an enormous incentive for trafficking.
So absent this, so we've got the issue of the Flores settlement, which remains unchanged. That's still the policy. Then also this week, you had the Trump administration issuing new guidelines to officials who interview asylum seekers. And among other things, they are now supposed to basically reject applicants who say they're escaping domestic or gang violence. Those are no longer legitimate reasons on their face. Crossing the border without documentation might on its own be grounds to just reject an application. Where does that leave us, Ed?
Basically, the administration is doing everything it can to keep down the number of people who are coming over through basically illegal means. And you know, all of this will eventually get challenged in court. But I'll say this. One of the elements of all this week is, remember, the administration had tried to enact this zero-tolerance policy where if you got in, you got out. And then they were going to try to detain these families. They are now releasing some of these families with young children with ankle bracelets, basically, so that they can track them. That is, in essence, a version of the catch-and-release policy, official or unofficial, as it existed before Trump was president. And it was basically an acknowledgement that there's no way to keep them, for now at least, and that they're just going to have to try to track them down. This point about kids, bringing kids across the border because it's easier to get in, is true. And I had a great example of it 2 weeks ago. I was down in Guatemala when the vice president was there. Stopped by a place where migrants basically spend a few nights after they've been returned to Guatemala. And there was a mother there waiting for her son, 15-year-old son, who had left with her husband from Guatemala in hopes of getting to Houston. They have four other kids. He took the 15-year-old boy with him. And I said, why? She said, because we were told by other people who lived in our village that if you go with a kid, you have a better chance of getting across. The father died in Mexico, and the kid was being returned to Guatemala. And she said, I just wish they'd never done it. But it's real. And word on the street down there was, if you take a kid, it'll be easier.
Let's talk about the Supreme Court. On Monday night, President Trump announced his choice to succeed Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is retiring soon. D.C. Appeals Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh also spoke to the nation. Here's some of what he said.
My judicial philosophy is straightforward. A judge must be independent and must interpret the law, not make the law. A judge must interpret statutes as written, and a judge must interpret the Constitution as written, informed by history and tradition and precedent.
Part of what Judge Brett Kavanaugh said this week. We don't want to linger on this. We've talked quite a bit about the Supreme Court and about Judge Kavanaugh this week on our program. But, Eugene, I just wonder if we're any clearer on what the Democrats' strategy is for dealing with this confirmation. Republicans don't really need any help from any Democrats to get this done. Is there anything Democrats can do besides complain?
In terms of strategy, the only thing that Democratic lawmakers have expressed is really trying to mine his rulings. This is a judge who's been on the court for a while and trying to make it clear to their constituents that this is a judge that they don't think will rule in the future in the best interest of America as a whole, especially people on the left. But that's pretty much what we would have been able to expect from them with anybody.
I got to say, Inez, this feels like the most bulletproof part of Donald Trump's legacy at this point. No matter whatever else you think, if you're a social conservative and you voted for Donald Trump, just these two appointments, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, if they get done, boom, that's his legacy. And it's if you're a social conservative, it's unassailable.
Well, I think there were a lot of conservatives who were uncomfortable with Donald Trump and pulled the lever. And they were really debating, like, can I pull the lever for this guy? And one of the key factors was Supreme Court appointments. And he's proven that he's going to, I mean, I think in Gorsuch, he had a home run for conservatives. Brett Kavanaugh, probably more in between Roberts and Alito, but still a solid conservative pick for the Supreme Court. I think he's really assuaged the doubts of people who might have not been as enthusiastic to vote for him.
Few people get to leave prison in style like Steve and Dwight Hammond. The father-son pair of ranchers from Oregon were given a lift home on a private jet after President Trump pardoned them on Tuesday. The Hammonds were convicted of arson back in 2012 for starting a fire that damaged federally owned land. Remember that armed standoff between the federal government and the militia that was led by that guy Cliven Bundy? Their conviction prompted the standoff. Ed O'Keefe, what message is the president sending by pardoning these two?
Well, they're another example of a case that has been championed by a lot of the president's supporters, basically getting his attention and having him rule in their favor. He has pardoned seven people so far during his presidency. It seems that in the last few months he's finally sorted out that he can do this, and he can basically do this on his own with no legal or congressional intervention. And, you know, so you combine this with the full pardon of Scooter Libby and others in the last few weeks, and it's, you know, it's just something he can do and something he's going to continue to do.
Inez?
Yeah, I mean, I think, one, this is another mandatory minimums case, right?
Right.
Which is like Alice Johnson. The other aspect of this that I just really wanted to bring up and I think is not as well known on the East Coast or even in the Midwest is how much federal land exists in the West. People think, like, why would the ranchers have a problem with, I mean, they don't have a right to graze their cattle on federal land. That's the kind of thinking that somebody who doesn't live in one of those states might have. The feds own about 90% of Nevada, right? So if you are going to be a rancher, you have to interact with the federal government and with federal land. And I think that's a point that gets missed a lot on this coast.
We did have a long conversation about that when we visited KUER Public Radio in Salt Lake City. You'll find that conversation online at the1a.org. Two more stories we wanted to get to before our time is up. The Department of Justice is reopening the investigation into the murder of Emmett Till more than 60 years after he was killed in the small town of Money, Mississippi. Till, a black teenager, was murdered after he was accused of harassing Carolyn Bryant Donham, a white woman. Decades later, doubt about her story came to light when she admitted that she lied. Tim Tyson is the author of The Blood of Emmett Till. He's the one who interviewed her. He spoke to us about this last year.
What exactly did she tell you? Like, what was the confession exactly?
Well, a lot of beans were spilled, but the main thing was in reference to, you know, there's the piece of the story that is about Emmett Till going around the counter, grabbing her around the waist, you know, forcefully, not letting her go, speaking sexually to her and all of that. Of that piece, she said, that part's not true.
Part of our conversation with Tim Tyson, the author of the book, The Blood of Emmett Till. One more story we'd like to get to before we let you go. The Emmy nominations came out this week, and for the first time in 18 years, HBO does not have the most. It got 108 nominations, especially for Westworld, Game of Thrones, and the comedy series Barry. Netflix got 112. Largely for The Crown, Godless, and Stranger Things. It's the first time that a streaming service has led the nominations. By the way, this marks 70 years since the Television Academy chose the current design for the statuette. Emmy, with an I, was an old slang term for a camera. The Academy changed that to Emmy, with an E, after picking the current design. A winged woman representing the television arts, holding up an atom representing the sciences. TV engineer Lewis McManus modeled the statuette after his wife. Inez Stepman is a senior contributor with The Federalist. Inez, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Ed O'Keefe, political correspondent with CBS News. Ed, have a good weekend.
You too.
And Eugene Scott, political reporter with The Washington Post. Eugene, always good talking to you.
Likewise.
We leave you today with the music of Bob Dureau. You may recognize his work on the series Schoolhouse Rock. This week, the National Endowment for the Arts announced that he is one of this year's Jazz Masters. It's the nation's highest honor for jazz. Dureau learned that he had received the honor before he passed away in April at the age of 94. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
And three times one.
What is it?
Three!
Yeah. That's a magic number.
A man and a woman had a little baby. Yes, they did. They had three in the family. That's a magic number.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look, it happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The biggest international drama of the week had all the makings of a Hollywood movie. After last week's discovery that a dozen youth soccer players and their coach were, in fact, alive inside a flooded cave in Thailand, the days-long rescue had the world holding its breath. First, three of the boys were freed, then a few more, and finally all of them were brought to safety. Cheers for that happy ending were rivaled only by cheers from pro soccer fans at the ongoing drama of the World Cup. Well, some of the fans, anyway. France and Croatia will play in the final. There's a lot to discuss, including President Trump's trip to Europe and the upcoming summit in Helsinki with his Russian counterpart. Joining us in the studio to discuss all of it is Mark Landler, White House correspondent for The New York Times, and the author of Alter Egos, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and the Twilight Struggle Over American Power. Mark, welcome back to the Roundup.
Great to be here, Joshua.
Also glad to welcome back Nancy Youssef, a national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, welcome.
Always a pleasure.
And Ed Luce, chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. His latest book is called The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Ed, glad to have you with us.
Great to be here, Joshua.
Well, President Trump is in Great Britain for a diplomatic visit, and he's already thrown a rhetorical grenade into the trip. The president openly second-guessed the way Britain's Prime Minister, Theresa May, has handled her country's exit from the European Union. He did so in an interview with the British tabloid The Sun.
I would have done it much differently. I actually told Theresa May how to do it, but she didn't agree with it. She didn't listen to me.
What did she say?
She didn't listen. No, I told her how to do it. That will be up to her to say. But I told her how to do it. She wanted to go a different route.
Mm. So you would be prepared to walk away if they didn't give you the right terms?
Oh, absolutely. I think what's going on is very unfortunate.
President Trump speaking to Tom Newton Dunn, the political editor of The Sun. Now, that happened just yesterday. Today, the president did a complete 180 on his comments during a joint press conference with the prime minister. He called his Sun interview fake news. He said he did not criticize Theresa May. And he kind of suggested he had his own recording of the interview that would corroborate that. He also reversed course on the future of a UK-US trade deal. Yesterday, during that interview with The Sun, the president claimed that Prime Minister May's handling of the UK's exit from the EU, the Brexit, would kill the prospects of a free trade agreement. Today, he said the deal was going ahead. Ed Luce, what? I don't even know where to start with this. He's basically gone back and forth on two things he said on the record, on tape. And when a reporter asked him about it, he was like, fake news, I have my own recording. You didn't hear what you thought you heard. What?
Yeah, what is kind of a good question. I should remind everybody, this is Friday the 13th, and weird things happen on these dates.
Yeah, you know, right. You're going to believe yourself or your lying ears?
Exactly.
Right.
The fact that there's this audio there and Trump saying, no, it's the internet, it's fake news, and then quotes Theresa May standing next to him and saying, oh, it's just the press. Meaning she agreed that this must be fake news, just added to the sort of Alice in Wonderland quality of this whole thing. But the plain fact is that the detractors of Theresa May, who's in a very, very wobbly situation. The Brexiteers, two of whom resigned from her cabinet this week, Boris Johnson and David Davis, the Brexit Secretary and Foreign Secretary, will now be emboldened by the remarks that were recorded by the Sun interviewer, because the entire basis of May's strategy is, look, once we have left the EU, we will still have good access to the EU, but we will then be able to strike trade deals with the rest of the world, first and foremost with the United States. And Trump said on that audio very clearly, and claims to have said in private to Theresa May many times, that that will not be possible. If Britain is part of the EU regulatory goods system, it cannot strike a trade deal with the United States.
And just to be clear, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but just so we can be clear on what the president's argument is, if I understand it correctly, he's basically saying we want to strike a deal with the UK acting as an independent trade region. And if you're still so closely interwoven with the EU, if the policies are still so simpatico, that means the EU has too much influence over the UK, and we basically are dealing with them through you. And that's not what we want.
The UK would essentially be, under May's proposal, a rule taker. It would be European regulations that the UK goods would be subjected to. And therefore, Trump says, we wouldn't be negotiating with you. You'd be the EU. And he stated very clearly in the press conference, the EU has a horrible trade surplus with us of $151 billion. And that has to end.
Now, the Trump administration has been very quick to downplay this interview. The press secretary, Sarah Sanders, said in a statement right after the Sun interview, quote, the president likes and respects Prime Minister May very much, unquote. Again, just this morning, the president called the recorded interview fake news. Nancy Youssef, has this had a larger impact on the trip overall? I mean, in a real world sense. He and Theresa May were very chummy this morning. He praised her again and again. There is some praise for her in the Sun interview, so it's not all negative. And the president made that point. Is this just kind of the sensational, the heat around this trip, or is there more to it?
Well, I think in terms of the trip, it's part of a pattern of sort of put aside inconsistent remarks of ambiguity about what was produced from these visits. What specifically did NATO agree to? What specifically did the UK and the United States discuss, and what will come of it? I thought it was interesting that he seemed to suggest this morning in a press conference with the prime minister that he had a change of heart, having spent quite a bit of time with her and what seemed to be more impressed with her. He kept calling her an impressive woman and didn't say it, but somehow suggested that he had had a change of heart about her after the black tie affair and spending so much time, made reference to the fact that it had breakfast and lunch, and again we're having breakfast and lunch, and which says that personality reinforces this idea of personal relations are so important to the president in determining how he interacts, and then also how he even looks at policy. Because yesterday, when he seemed to suggest that the relationship with his nadir comes back a day later and completely reverses course.
Mark Landler, interesting to see the images on Regent Street in London of the protests that are taking place. What kind of impact have these protests had, and how much does this reflect how the UK feels about the president? Is this just a loud minority?
No, it's not a loud minority. Trump is a profoundly unpopular leader. He's probably the most unpopular American president. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here in the post-war period. I mean, there have been periods where Ronald Reagan was extremely unpopular in Europe around the time of the Pershing missiles debate. There have been other areas around trade and other issues where American presidents have alienated themselves. Of course, George W. Bush in the Iraq War. But it's really hard to remember a time when any American president has been an object, not just of opposition, but of undisguised ridicule. And that's what we're seeing here. And I do think it has a lingering effect. I wanted to just pick up on one of the things you were talking about earlier and that Nancy mentioned. I think with Trump, there's now a very predictable pattern on foreign trips. Trump creates a crisis. He precipitates a crisis. He does it deliberately, almost methodically. And then he cleans up the crisis. And I think this is really a reality TV approach to statecraft. He did it at the NATO summit in the same way, making unreasonable demands, causing all kinds of dissent, and then emerging the next day to say, well, in fact, the alliance is more united than ever behind my new program. He did it to some extent with the North Korean Korea summit in Singapore a few weeks ago. This is a discernible pattern by a president who ran on the theme that I alone can fix it. He creates a crisis. He then appears to fix it and emerges as the hero of his own script. The problem is, as Ed said earlier, the damage is done by what he said the night before in the Sun interview or in the private meeting with NATO leaders. That's not damage that gets fixed because he emerges the next day and utters platitudes about leaders getting along well and Theresa May being a special person.
We're speaking to Mark Landler of the New York Times, Nancy Youssef of the Wall Street Journal, and Ed Luce of the Financial Times. Regarding the news conference today, Scooter writes, Trump does the same thing in America that he's doing in England. He tells one faction what they want to hear and tells the other faction what they want to hear because he knows both sides aren't listening to each other or getting their news from the same source, and no one holds him accountable. Something else, Ed, that came out in that Sun interview were his comments about immigration in Europe, some of which Theresa May also had to, I don't want to say, she didn't outright contradict them, but she presented a counterpoint to them. What about those comments?
So this is what I think differentiates Trump from any of his predecessors. He's not just saying you've got to pay more, you're free riders, you've got to increase your defense spending. He is actively undermining liberal democracy in Western Europe. He is again and again tweeted and used his ambassador in Berlin, Rick Grenell, to undermine Merkel's very shaky coalition. He is now on a podium today with Theresa May, again repeated that Boris Johnson would make a great prime minister. This is her mortal enemy. So he's attempting overtly to topple a government there. And he is using the arguments that the enemies of Merkel and May are using, which is immigration is destroying our cultures, which is that multiculturalism is leading to the end of the West. So this is of an entirely different caliber to the kinds of unpopularity that Bush or Reagan or other American presidents may have courted during periods of the Cold War. This is an American president who is actively undermining Western democracy on the soil of so-called allies.
One more story out of the UK we wanted to get to before we talk NATO. A British woman who was exposed to a deadly nerve agent 2 weeks ago has died. Dawn Sturgis and her boyfriend Charlie Rowley both got seriously ill after somehow being exposed to the nerve agent known as Novichok in late June. Rowley awoke from a 10-day coma on Tuesday. Ms. Sturgis had died 2 days before. Now, Mark, authorities confirmed that the nerve agent is the same one that was used on Sergei Skripal, a former Russian spy, and his daughter. That was back in March. The British government accused Russia of sponsoring that attack. What do we know about this one? Novichok only came from the Soviet Union, so it seems unlikely that it either didn't come from Russia directly or with Russian input, but where does that stand?
Yeah, there's little doubt that the agent probably came from Russia. The question and the mystery here is how this couple, who have no connection to Russia, not former spies, an innocent British couple, somehow came into contact with it. And there's a number of theories about it's in a fine powder form. Perhaps it could have settled on a railing and one of the two of them brushed up against it. Perhaps one of them picked up a container that had somehow contained it or residue from it. So, you know, that's what will be the object or the subject of an investigation. Obviously, the broader diplomatic repercussions are large here, and the British authorities have already said that they will hold the Russians accountable for this. The Russians have answered with, a combination of bluster and suggesting that somehow this was a conspiracy cooked up by the Brits to discredit Russia around the time of the World Cup. But it was even a subject today in the news conference with Theresa May and Donald Trump. And Trump reminded the television audience that he took very strong action, expelled a lot of Russian diplomats in solidarity with Britain after the Skripal poisoning. This was an attempt by him to show that he's actually tough on Russia, despite his aspiration for a friendship with Vladimir Putin. But clearly this will play out. The mystery maybe will be solved, maybe it won't be solved. But in any event, it's simply once again again underlines the malign role that Russia plays and the pressure on Western leaders in dealing with Putin to keep Russia's feet to the fire.
I should note before we move on from the press conference that a number of listeners commented on the way that Mr. Trump spoke about Mrs. May in the lens of how he speaks to female foreign leaders. Babette tweeted, Trump is an embarrassment to our country when he goes overseas. Would another POTUS, President of the United States, would another POTUS speak about another world leader the way he spoke about Theresa May? His sexist attitude when speaking about his advice on Brexit came through loud and clear. Let's talk about the trip he took before he went to the UK. His first stop on his week-long European trip was to Belgium for the NATO summit. After the UK, he heads to Finland to meet with Vladimir Putin. We'll get to the Finland trip in just a second, but first let's talk NATO. That trip highlighted many of the ways the president has kind of upended America's foreign policy, remade it in big ways. At the end of the NATO summit, Trump said America's ties to NATO are very strong, and he added that he won big concessions on defense spending.
We made a tremendous amount of progress today. It's been about, at a minimum, they estimate, and they're going to be giving you exact numbers. But since last year, they've raised an additional $33 billion that's been put up by the various countries, not including the United States. And the United States' commitment to NATO is very strong, remains very strong, but primarily because everyone, the spirit they have, the amount of money they're willing to spend, the additional money that they will be putting up, has been really, really amazing to see it.
Now, France's president, Emmanuel Macron, disputed that NATO allies were actually going to increase their military spending commitments beyond what they are right now. Nancy Youssef, before we get into what happened here, we should step back a little bit and explain what we were talking about when we're talking about the money. There's two different things here. There's the money nations pay into NATO, the independent organization, and the money they spend on their own defense, right?
That's right. And so NATO, of course, was founded in 1949, and we didn't really hear talk about money until around the early 2000s, really in the run-up to the Iraq War. And during the war, we started hearing talk about metrics because you had different members contributing various amounts and somehow some benefiting more than others. And so former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates famously in 2011 talked about two tiers, that there are those who pay and then those who benefit, and that's not always the same thing. And so into the lexicon came this idea of 2%, that each NATO member should contribute, should be spending 2% of its GDP on national defense. The United States is at about 3.5%. At the summit, the president, and I should say in 2014, there was an agreement reached that all NATO countries would try to reach that goal by 2024. They had 10 years. And so what made this week so interesting is that the president at one point apparently called for the nations to reach that goal immediately. I'd also like to point out when we talk about 2%, 2% in some ways is a misleading figure because there are some nations that spend a lot of money, more than the 2%, let's say Greece, but they spend it on personnel. And someone could argue that it's a jobs program for Greece. And there are other countries that, like Estonia, which is pretty high in terms of its contributions, but really specializes in things like cyber defense. And so one of the things that has come out of this discussion, I think, is arguably focusing too much on the number rather than the contributions that a military is making.
That gets exactly to a question from Phil in Indianapolis. Phil asked, NATO was created to balance the then USSR and the Eastern Bloc. I don't think anyone feels Russia will send tanks over the border if NATO members fall to less than 2% of their budgets. The future of war will be cyber and electronics based. Does the 2% Trump asks European nations to spend relate only to direct military spending like armaments? Or can a European nation spend it on electronic defenses to protect infrastructure and offense to disrupt an aggressor nation? Nancy, it sounds like you're saying that 2% can be more than just boots on the ground.
That's right. I mean, it can be, and some nations will spend it on equipment. It really varies because you have 29 nations. And I would also point out this idea of NATO sort of speaking with one voice vis-a-vis Russia has really dissipated. When you look at the NATO members, there are countries like Hungary and Italy and Bulgaria that are closer to Trump's position vis-a-vis Russia than some of the conventional or older NATO members. And so that's what made this so interesting. This meeting is designed to show a unified voice. And that sounds like a small thing that's as a goal, but it's a critical thing in an organization like NATO. And so I think one could argue that Trump's comments and the back and forth on the 4% really really highlighted the growing divisions among such a wide spectrum of NATO members.
And the nature of that division seemed to be one of the big things that leaders in NATO and the European Council, like Donald Tusk, who's the president of the European Council, tried to speak against. He spoke directly to President Trump and America about Europe's role with relationship with the U.S. on Tuesday ahead of the summit. Here is part of what Donald Tusk said.
I would therefore have two remarks here. First of all, dear America, appreciate your allies. After all, you don't have that many. And dear Europe, spend more on your defense, because everyone respects an ally that is well-prepared and equipped.
That's Donald Tusk, who's the president of the European Council, speaking on Tuesday ahead of the summit. I wonder, Ed Luce, what you make of what Donald Tusk said. The president had harsh words for Germany. He obviously ended up differing with Emmanuel Macron about the military expenditure, the agreement. But I do take that part of his comment where he said, appreciate your allies. After all, you don't have that many.
Well, I think that was an unsubtle dig at how quickly and deliberately and repeatedly Trump appears to be alienating his allies. I mean, to pick up on what Nancy said, there is an echo here of Donald Rumsfeld's division between old Europe and new Europe. There is this division within America's NATO partners, the Viktor Orbans and Matteo Salvini's of Europe are far more closely aligned with Putin, far more Trump-sounding in their expressions of admiration for Putin. And if you ask, you know, what is the purpose of NATO in a post-Cold War world? Well, you can talk about joint operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, but essentially it's as a bulwark against Russia.
And I'm sorry, just to be clear, Viktor Orban is the Prime Minister of Hungary, Matteo Salvini is the Prime Minister of Italy.
Absolutely. And so if, you know, significant and growing numbers of European members of NATO are actually aligning with a more Trumpian, let's say, highly forgiving view of Putin's actions as Russia's leader, then you have to question the very sort of existential basis of NATO. This is way more than a debate about, you know, how you count military spending and whether you're meeting those targets.
Mark, before we move on from this to talk about that summit with Vladimir Putin, what concrete things came out of the summit that we should pay attention to? Among other things, I note that Canada seemed to be taking the lead on Iraq's strategy going forward. Were there any other concrete changes we should remember?
You know, I don't think there's anything that matters as much as the battle they had and the internal squabbles. I actually think it's a mistake to suggest that something good came out of this summit. And so I push back on the idea that evidence that one country or the other was taking the lead on something is a positive development. I think the overriding result of this summit was that it showcased divisions. On the eve of a meeting between Trump and a foreign leader whose entire agenda is built around engendering divisions in that alliance. So that's where I would put the emphasis.
That foreign meeting, it was on the mind of Fran, who's listening from Raleigh, North Carolina. Fran writes, is it true that Trump plans a one-on-one with Putin with no other person from our government in the room? I just cannot imagine the Republicans who have forever distrusted Russia not pushing back on this. Unbelievable. Well, it is true that the Helsinki summit between Presidents Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin begins on Monday. We'll be talking about it in greater depth as next week goes on. But Nancy, is that true? Is that one of the risks of this summit, that it'll just be Putin and Trump with just a translator in the room?
That's been suggested. It's hard for me to tell you definitively because we don't have an agenda. We don't have sort of an outline of what's going to happen to say with any specificity in terms of what will be discussed, who will be in the room, what are the outcomes that the United States wants to have come out of it, what are the things that the Russians will be asking. We haven't had any of that sort of framework to be able to say anything definitively. And so it appears that way, but it would be hard for me to say that definitively.
Mark?
I think there is an intention to have both a one-on-one session and what they call an expanded session. The issue with Putin is, historically, Putin likes to limit the size of even the expanded session. And he does so because he has a very small number, about three or so people he likes to have in these meetings, and he insists on the other side limiting it to three. The problem for the U.S. with that is if you limit it to three, you make it very difficult, if not impossible, to include any Russia expert. Fiona Hill, who's the NSC senior director for Russia, would be excluded from a 1+3 format.
The National Security Council.
The National Security Council, that's right. So I think that's another issue, even if there's something beyond the one-on-one. But I just think there's one more broader point to make here. I think it becomes increasingly irrelevant how many people are in the room with Trump, given the lack of control any of his aides have over what direction the meeting is going to go in and the lack of predictability of what the president's going to do. It is useful to have people in the room to listen to what the president says to the foreign leader, but it is now almost useless in terms of having any control over the direction the meeting goes in.
Ed Luce, I remember when we were talking about the summit in Singapore between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, that just the fact that they are photographed together, that they get to have this meeting together, is a big feather in Chairman Kim's cap, regardless of whatever else might have happened in that meeting. Is this a similar situation where just being able for Vladimir Putin to be able to say, I was in a room with President Trump, he met me for a meeting in Finland, is just an inherent feather in his cap? Or would something more have to come of it for him to count it as a victory?
I think in and of itself, it's a feather in his cap. They've only met once directly before. That was a year ago in Hamburg. And, you know, they've spoken many times on the phone. But the timing and the context of this is much more useful to Putin than that. Given that it's come after this highly controversial and volatile NATO summit, which has left NATO morale at a low ebb, and that it's, you know, four days later, and also after Trump has sort of dissed, if you permit me to use that word, the special relationship, although then, of course, reversed dissed.
Right.
To meet Trump in that context is highly valuable. But I think the content of their one-to-one meeting is going to be something that Putin's going to be looking forward to seeing what he can get out of Trump. And I guess we can discuss the kinds of things on the agenda.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that the president said he was asked in the news conference today whether or not he would ask about Russian meddling in the election, and he said he will absolutely firmly ask about that in the meeting. Nancy?
I would make an important distinction between the North Korean meeting and this one, in that for the North Koreans, that appearance was very, very important, and there wasn't an expectation at that point of a long list of specifics, whereas here the president has indicated some of the specifics he'll talk about, and some of them would be quite upending in terms of how we know things. Today at that press conference you mentioned, he was asked about the possibility of suspending NATO military exercises, and he said perhaps we'll talk about that. He mentioned Crimea as something he might talk about. He talked about nuclear proliferation. So important, heavy, substantive issues has already been sort of floated around that will be discussed, whereas at the summit, the optics were sort of the primary objective, at least for the North Koreans and to some degree for the United States.
Someone else who will be in Helsinki for the summit next week is Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. This comes while it's looking more and more like his trip to Pyongyang last weekend was not terribly successful. He met with North Korean officials to keep discussing denuclearization. He addressed his trip at a press conference during the NATO summit.
We had a productive conversation. There remains a great deal of work to do. But I think most importantly, my counterpart Kim Jong-chol made a commitment consistent with what President Trump was able to achieve with Chairman Kim, which was they intend to denuclearize, they're going to accomplish it, and now the task is to get it implemented.
North Korean officials called those same meetings, in their words, deeply regrettable, and there are now also reports that the North Koreans didn't show up for a planned meeting yesterday about returning the remains of America's soldiers missing from the Korean War. Mark, is this a failure of the talks, or is this just North Korea talking tough, or maybe talking falsely?
I mean, to some extent, this is par for the course with the North Koreans. They're a very difficult negotiating partner. They often skip meetings. Anyone in the Bush administration or the Clinton administration that negotiated with North Korea will tell you that most of these things sound familiar. That said, it is very clear that Mike Pompeo is involved in a very different exercise than Donald Trump seems to think that the United States is involved in. And the disjunction between the president and his Secretary of State on North Korea is actually becoming truly remarkable.
Before we move on from Mike Pompeo, it's also worth noting that he is in Mexico today meeting with its new president-elect, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Mark Landler, I wonder what we can expect from that meeting, particularly based on what some of the president-elect's rhetoric was leading up to his election.
Well, I mean, the interesting big theme here is the newly elected president of Mexico is a populist, except he's a left-wing populist. So on the face of it, one could expect fireworks between the new president, who goes by the nickname AMLO, and Donald Trump. Interestingly, in the aftermath of the election, AMLO has taken a very conciliatory posture toward the president, said he wants to have a productive relationship, says he wants to successfully renegotiate NAFTA. And so I'm sure Mike Pompeo is going down there to try to cement this good start, if you will. I thought it was also interesting and noteworthy that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who has made a sort of a sideline of trying to mend fences between the U.S. and Mexico, is accompanying Mike Pompeo on that trip. I think, though, that, look, the underlying reality here, given the politics in Mexico and the politics in the United States and the two figures we have here, is that we can probably expect a rocky relationship at some point. We're trying, obviously, on both sides to avoid getting into the tough stuff right away.
Oh, you know what? Before we move on from Mike Pompeo, Nancy Youssef, what about Helsinki? Do we expect him to have any significant role in that Helsinki trip next week?
I think it's impossible to say that he wouldn't have a big role because he has become a very important player in this administration. He has the president's ear. It's clear that he's very influential. So it's hard. It's impossible to rule him out. And given his influence on things like North Korea, which will come up presumably, and also Syria, which, of course, would fall under his purview as Secretary of State, it'd be hard to imagine him not having some influence, if not in shaping the discussion, really shaping some of the requests that the U.S. makes of Russia on key foreign policy issues.
Interesting to kind of contemplate what this meeting would be like if Rex Tillerson was still the Secretary of State. Like, it's part of the whole push behind elevating Mike Pompeo to this job in a way, is that he's a little more hawkish in line with the president's view.
Well, I'll give you an example on Syria. Mike Pompeo has been very aggressive about his distaste for Iranian expanded influence in the Middle East in a way that Rex Tillerson wasn't. And so the U.S. policy right now vis-a-vis Syria is to stop ISIS and hasn't really addressed what to do about Iranian expansion. Under a Rex Tillerson, I don't know if this would be so much at the forefront of the discussions of these talks as they are with Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State.
Mark?
The only point I'd throw into all this is sort of been interesting to me over the past few weeks. I wonder how much of Mike Pompeo's energy and time is going to be consumed by North Korea. If he continues to be the frontline diplomat on this issue, given the way the North Koreans operate, you could see him spending a great deal of time. It's almost analogous to me of the final days of Condi Rice's time as Secretary of State when she traveled to the Middle East something like 12 times to try to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian issue. It is a danger for a Secretary of State to allow themselves to be too sucked into one thing. And I think I see a bit of that emerging with Mike Pompeo on North Korea.
A story out of India that caught our attention this week, and we should say this is a story that made news this week, but this is an issue that is not new, and we're overdue in discussing it on this program. A 15-year-old was allegedly repeatedly raped by her teachers and classmates over a span of 6 months. 19 people were accused in this case. 7 of them have been arrested thus far that we know of. Now, this comes after a massive protest movement back in April to end sexual violence against women following the rape and murder of a girl who was just 8 years old. Ed, what do we know about this most recent case?
We know that this is part of what public opinion in India believes is a common pattern of rape, particularly in states like Bihar, which is one of the most least developed parts of India, one of the most backward states, where women are too scared to report rape, let alone children, because quite frequently they are taken in and raped in the police station. There is an extraordinary epidemic of impunity towards rape victims. The sort of current wave of public revulsion against this perceived epidemic of rape began in 2012 when a young woman on a bus in Delhi was raped and killed. She eventually died by four boys, three of whom have been sentenced to death in the past few days. India uses the death penalty very sparingly, but under the political pressure, the mass revulsion that's gone on, the government, the Indian government, Narendra Modi's government, has said that the death penalty should apply in extreme rape cases. And so this is a very, very hot political issue. It's been hot for 6 years. The other sort of dimension to it is the most recent sort of mass demonstrations, which were in April, which were in response to this 8-year-old girl, Muslim girl, who was kidnapped and held and raped repeatedly in a local temple, is that the BJP, the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party, is alleged, I think quite plausibly, to have helped cover up and try and protect the alleged rapists in that case. So there is a political dimension to this, not just about women's powerlessness in rural areas, but about the powerlessness of minorities in a time of Hindu nationalism.
Do we know, in addition to the politics of this, what else is behind this epidemic? Is this, I imagine part of this, you mentioned some of it is economic. There are poorer parts of India where this issue is either more prevalent or a tougher problem to make headway in. But what other factors are fueling this epidemic?
Well, there is, I mean, in terms of sociology, a big gender imbalance developing, particularly in the north of India, the cow belt, the Hindi belt, which is poorer than the sort of more prosperous south, between girls and boys. There are just a lot more boys than girls, to put it bluntly. And that has created, with the average age of India now being under 25, a whole sort of generation of boys that just don't have much prospect of marriage. So there is a social pressure there to do with gender imbalance that goes far deeper and makes this a much more complex issue than the mere politics we're seeing in recent weeks.
Nancy?
As Ed was saying, in 2012, there was a national uproar and led to a law passed that made it illegal in a death penalty case, potentially, for those convicted of raping anyone, male or female, under 12. And what's interesting was the following year, there was a huge uptick in reported cases. But since that time, the number of convictions have stayed steadily at 28%. And one could argue that that's a contributing factor, that while India has tried to make changes legally, it has not been able to get past the threshold of convictions, which one could argue is leading some to be reticent to report. And remember, the cases that are reported are arguably a small fraction of what's actually happening.
It is worth noting that even as this horrific story was breaking in India, through the week, the world has been watching a story that turned out to have an extremely happy ending. All 12 of those soccer players and their coach were rescued from a flooded cave in Thailand after being trapped for nearly 3 weeks. CBS interviewed Tanet Natisi, who is one of the leaders of the rescue.
What was it like for you to see those first kids come out?
I got really emotional. Yeah, all my team are. You know, when we heard the news, all my team just cried. Like, we've been working so hard for the past 5 days, and it's just finally see it happens. Yeah, that's something.
Tanet Natisi, one of the leaders of the rescue, speaking to CBS News. Mark Landler, this was a heck of a rescue. You had, I don't even think I realized how difficult it was until they showed me like a diagram of where this cave was. It was like 2.5 miles through this shaft that was at its deepest point, 4,100 feet under the surface. This rescue was incredible.
And what's interesting is that in the end, the divers brought the kids out in sort of a fairly low-tech kind of way. You know, there'd been a lot of talk about could they bore a kind of a tunnel through the mountain and get to them that way. You know, you saw Elon Musk, the car designer, actually create a mini sub that he shipped over to Thailand that could go through the tunnel and bring the kids out that way. And in the end, you know, they did it kind of, if you will, the old-fashioned way. They guided them out through the tunnel. tunnel by use of a guide rope. So, you know, just once in a while, there's a story that's just an unambiguously happy thing. It reminded me very much of the Chilean miners in that regard. Mm-hmm. And sadly, one thing that I felt about it was that the afterglow didn't last very long. You know, after about Monday or Tuesday, we weren't really talking about it anymore. And it's just sort of a reality of this tumultuous world we live in, that even something that is this inspiring can be kind of ephemeral. And that's one thing that struck me about it.
Also worth noting something that RSB Sale noted on our website, the1a.org. Everyone neglects to mention the death of the Thai Navy SEAL when discussing the rescue of the kids. While it's great that those kids got out of the cave, let's not forget the man who died trying to rescue them. True enough, absolutely. The maybe the fact also that people moved on from this story was that there was another big international story going on with which we'd like to end the roundup, and that's, of course, the World Cup. The final is in Russia this weekend. France and Croatia will go for the cup. The French team beat Belgium on Tuesday, and after that, people were more than slightly excited. Here's part of what we heard from the report by NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Horns honking in the streets of France, and then, of course, Croatia made it into the finals after a nail-biter against England on July 11th. The World Cup is obviously huge international news, and joining us for the end of the roundup to discuss it is Roger Bennett, co-host of the podcast and NBC Sports show Men in Blazers. He also hosts WNYC's latest podcast special, American Fiasco, and he is the author of the Encyclopedia Blazertanica. Raj, welcome to 1A.
Oh, Joshua, it's an honor to be here with you.
It's an honor to have you. This has been a heck of a World Cup. I should get right to it. What should we, particularly those of us who aren't avid World Cup fans, what should we be watching as we watch the final?
Oh, you'll be one of a billion people tuning in from around the world to see France. As an Englishman, I've just become American. But still, the last vestiges of Englishness that cling to me are those of finding it incredibly difficult to enjoy watching French happiness and French glory. They are most certainly the favored team. They are a rippled muscle of elite talent. They have so many offensive weapons, but their coach has decided to make them a risk-averse team. They play defense first with incredible ability. They rarely concede. They have the star of the tournament, this young 19-year-old sensation, Kylian Mbappe. I don't know about you, but when I was 19, I was interested in mixtapes, trying to drink beer and watch soccer. He has become the world's darling and is playing with the whole world watching his talents, with incredible clubs swirling around him. They'll be playing Croatia, who are massive underdogs. A nation of 4.1 million people makes them about as big as Oregon, the 27th biggest state, or half the size of London. They destroyed England, shattered the nation's hopes in the semi-final. They have a duo in the middle, two little guys, Rakitic and Modric, who are a delight. It's like watching one of the great, but it's like watching Wham reunite to play football together in perfect harmony. Simon and Garfunkel playing Central Park, but Croatian style. It's going to be phenomenal. There's no pressure on Croatia, which is why they could just make an upset happen.
Raj, I know our time with you is short. What's your read on how Russia has done as the host of the World Cup this time around?
I have to say, whoever wins, Croatia or France on Sunday, there's really only one winner of this World Cup, Joshua, and that is Vladimir Putin. He's had an incredible World Cup. Not only did his Russian team surprise on a darling, possibly slightly doped up run, into the quarterfinals, which was a great boon for nationalist fervor in Russia. But the whole world has been in Russia, and I was there for a chunk of this World Cup. It was like the Truman Show. It was a reality show. Everything was so perfect, gussied up, every building freshly painted. I don't know what they've done since I was last in Moscow with the homeless population, the elderly. They were nowhere to be seen on the streets of Moscow. It was full of beautiful people. And the whole world came to Moscow, and everybody is leaving saying, Russia, what an amazing host. Russia, not as bad as I thought. Russia, what a joyous place to live. And in 1980, the Olympics there was meant to be about Russian power, mm-hmm. Russian might, the threat of Russia. In 2018 World Cup, the win for Putin has been normalizing Russia, making it a place like any other. And there's a darkness. It has been on the football field,
right,
the best World Cup of my lifetime. But when you realize this is Russia, rogue state Russia, there's an incredible darkness that underlies all of that joy.
Let me ask our guests here in studio predictions, France or Croatia? Mark?
Well, you know, Roger's right. France is a huge favorite, but Croatia was written off in the last two games because they were said to be too tired, and they still won. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say they win.
Nancy?
I can't still root for Egypt?
For 2020, yeah, if you want. For 2022, yeah, go ahead.
Then I'll say Croatia in the absence of Egypt.
Ed?
Two predictions. I hope it's Croatia because they beat England, and England will beat Belgium for the third place playoff.
The big game.
Roger Bennett, the host of Men in Blazers and the author of the Encyclopedia Blazertanica. Raj, thanks for talking to us.
Bring on the Women's World Cup, the real World Cup 2019. That's the one the world's waiting
for
now,
Joshua.
There you
go. Mark Landler of the New York Times, Ed Luce of the Financial Times, and Nancy Youssef of the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for starting the weekend with us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.